Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Kevin Zeese, who's an attorney and activist who served as Ralph Nader's spokesman in 2004 and is now co-director of It's Our Economy. He will discuss the ongoing demonstrations on Wall Street that have been met by police brutality. Kevin Zeese is planning on expanding the occupation of Wall Street to occupy Washington, D.C. on October the 6th, the 10th anniversary of the Afghanistan War. And then we'll look into deteriorating relations between the United States and Pakistan, where complaints about Pakistani duplicity that used to be muttered in private are now being publicly and bluntly stated by senior American officials like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Vali Nasser, who was recently senior advisor to the Obama administration's special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, joins us. Then finally, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Ellen Schultz joins us. She covered business, finance, and economics for The Wall Street Journal and has investigated the retirement crisis for decades. She is the author of a shocking new book, Retirement Heist: How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers. Joining me now is attorney and activist Kevin Zeese, who is the co-director of It's Our Economy, and he's the director of Come Home America and serves on the steering committee of the Bradley Manning Support Network and October2011.org. He's been active in third-party electoral politics and served as Ralph Nader's press secretary and spokesman in 2004. He ran for Maryland's U.S. Senate seat on the Green Party ticket in 2006 and was the only person ever nominated by the Green Party, Libertarian Party, and the Populist Party. He has a blog at michaelmoore.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Zeese.
Thanks for having me on.
And Kevin, it certainly strikes me as a somewhat mystifying irony that nobody has gone to jail for the 2008 economic meltdown that has caused this recession that lingers and is getting deeper. And yet, 100 protesters have been arrested for protesting this injustice.
That's right. And if you look at the videos of the protests, you'll find that they didn't do anything that deserved being arrested for. And Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC had an excellent commentary last night that we have on the October2011.org blog that describes one of the incidents where some women who were already captured by the police and behind a plastic holder were pepper sprayed by a commanding officer of the New York Police Department for no reason. And so it's not only being arrested, it's being arrested for no reason and being brutalized. And it's not working. It's actually resulting in a counter effect. You wouldn't be talking to me had it not been for that. The New York Post wouldn't have covered it had not been for that. Lawrence O'Donnell wouldn't have covered it had not for that. And so it's actually spurring more coverage, letting people get to know about it more, and it's actually spurring activity across the country. There's now a website called OccupyTogether.org that has occupations being planned or already ongoing in 41 cities across the country. And October 6th, we'll be doing probably the largest of the events, October2011.org, when we bring Tahrir Square to Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. So the police are trying to, you know, shut this down with force. The media is trying to shut it down by not covering it. But it's growing on its own. It's an organic movement that's developing and is going to have to be dealt with.
And the police inspector, Deputy Inspector Anthony Bologna, that you referred to, Kevin Zeese, who pepper sprayed the young women who were standing behind one of those police orange netted barriers, he's apparently named as a defendant in lawsuits that came out of the police bearing down on protesters during the Republican convention. So what's going on in the city of New York? I just was watching the other night on HBO Larry David's show, and there's a cameo with Michael Bloomberg, and everything is funny and lovely, and he seems like he's the best friend of the progressives and a cool guy. And yet he's clearly in charge, and so is his police commissioner Kelly, and they seem to. I mean, one has to assume that these orders are coming from the top, and they're trickling down.
No question. I think they're definitely coming from the top. You know, Bloomberg is very cozy with the Wall Street folks who dominate New York and dominate New York politics, and they don't want this occupation of Wall Street going on. They're working behind police barricades, these big financiers. That's not their style. They think they are above the law, and they have been treated as above the law. They've been put into the Obama administration rather than prosecuted. They've not been held accountable for their crimes, and they're getting wealthy off of taxpayer bailouts, and people are angry about that. I think Bloomberg is like many politicians. He puts on a face that tries to fool the public. I think that is also common for President Obama, sadly. You know, people think we got sold a great health care program when it basically was produced by Republicans at the American Enterprise Institute and was something that they supported, and in the end, progressives supported because they were fooled. These are professional politicians who have an intense corporate media that is very good at misleading and propagandizing the American public. It's not working, though, in this case, because you're seeing these occupations spread across the country. The lack of media coverage is balanced by the first 3 days of the Wall Street occupation having 1.5 million tweets on Twitter in 3 days, and yet the media isn't covered. What the media is really doing is undercutting themselves. Their credibility keeps diminishing and diminishing as they don't cover right. The police, their credibility diminishes. They get divided. If you see on these tapes of the police, some of the blue-collar police that were in the blue shirts, not the white-collar commanders, one of the blue-collar police, I can't believe he just maced her. You know, he says after the commander maces this woman who's held behind the orange barrier. So I think it's going to create divisions among police. In fact, there's a report that more than 100 police officers stayed home from work the next day to protest the abuse, and we've seen the abuse stop. I think the bad reaction they got in the media and maybe in their own department has led to them playing a very different role in the last couple of days.
Kevin Zeister, Tuesday's New York Times is carrying a story suggesting that the police have been planning for the what might happen in the United States, which what recently happened in England with the riots. That they were sort of overreacting or preempting a threat that didn't exist. I mean,
what's silly about that, Ian, though, is what sparked the riot in England was police abuse.
Right.
And that's what started it. So if the police overreact to peaceful protesters and do some serious damage to somebody, you're going to see a violent reaction. These are peaceful protesters trying to redress serious grievances of an economy in collapse and those who collapsed it profiting from it rather than being prosecuted for it.
And I guess the metaphor of the visual of the police protecting the bull on Wall Street says it all.
I love that visual.
Says it all.
They had the bull surrounded in a police cage in order to protect it from the protesters. I was there to see that. That was quite a vision to behold, was the bull trapped in a police pen.
Again, I'm speaking with Kevin Zeister, attorney and activist, about the protests on Wall Street, and he is organizing to expand the protests to Washington, D.C. On October the 6th, the 10th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan. When you mentioned earlier, Kevin, about that this is all being done at the behest of the Wall Streeters inside these big towers, the people that have took the global economy into a near-death experience to the brink of collapse and then were subsequently rewarded by the American taxpayers for their profligacy and their criminality, really. I don't think that is hardly a hyperbole here. Do you feel, though, that the country's starting to wake up? Because one of the most amazing ironies is that the people who really ran with the outrage at Wall Street were, in fact, the Tea Party, who were obviously co-opted by the Kochs and others and turned into a kind of astroturf operation. And I've always been mystified as to why the people, the Main Street America hasn't been up in arms about this.
Well, Main Street America has been up in arms about it. The problem is that the corporate media doesn't cover the people who oppose corporate power are saying. They cover people who support corporate power like the Tea Party. There have been more people arrested at the Wall Street demonstration than turn out for most Tea Party demonstrations. I've seen pictures of Tea Party demonstrations where there are more media than there are protesters. We don't get that on the progressive side when we challenge corporate power because our message undermines the owners of the half dozen news media outlets that exist on television. So because we oppose their power, we don't get covered, but we have on our website on October 2011.org an article that takes a snapshot of protests in the United States and shows that across the country, even putting aside the big protests in Madison and in Michigan and in Ohio against, you know, Republican governors, even putting aside those, there are protests across the country going on all the time. And that's why in this article, which we call Now is the Time, we say this is the time for us to come together in a big way and to make it something that the media cannot avoid but covering. And we've taken the approach on our page, if you look at the media page of October 2011, to build from the independent media up. We have about 75 independent media outlets covering it. We're urging all the people who come to see themselves as the media and bring their flip cams and their cell phones to take pictures. One of the remarkable things in Wall Street when they had that incident with the pepper spray was that attack was videotaped from four or five different people. And so when the police said that they didn't do it or that the whole tape's not being shown, we had four or five independent cameras showing it from different directions on exactly what happened. There's no way for Officer Bologna to deny this anymore because he's been caught on camera. The people are the media. We're at a point in our history where it's democracy versus corporations, participatory democracy versus concentrated finance-based corporations. And democracy of the media is a key battle, and we're seeing that democratization of the media as every single person is able to make news and project news, become a media outlet through Facebook and Twitter and social media and blogs and websites and email lists. We can reach thousands of people. And if the people come together in an intentional way, try to be the media, we can reach millions of people. And so we're approaching a tipping point where the corporate media's credibility is declining and the democratized media is increasing.
And Kevin Zeese, given that the wealthiest 1% has wealth equal to 95% of Americans, and the disparity is growing, and it's pretty clear. We saw the Republicans go to the mat to protect millionaires and billionaires, and then the president comes out with a tax on millionaires or a proposal to tax millionaires and billionaires. He's calling the Buffett rule, but when he announced that, he rather defensively talked about class warfare. The whole press and the mainstream media have bought into this notion of class warfare. They continually bring up this term, which is a defensive term. There's a good piece by Howell Raines, formerly with the New York Times, an editor on CNN, arguing that the progressives and the left and the Democrats should run with class warfare. That's not something to be defensive about. It's a reality.
Well, I think that's how most people on the progressive side feel, that the class warfare has been going on now for decades, and we haven't been fighting back. President Obama's very weak Buffett rule, the idea that a billionaire should pay equal to the secretary, to me is absurd. That should not be, you should be defensive that that's too weak, not too strong. But Obama's in a difficult position. He's trying to run the first ever billion-dollar presidential campaign. He's holding fundraisers that he charges $35,800 for people to attend. That is $1,000 more than the median individual income of Americans. So Americans could not afford to go to one fundraiser of his based on their whole annual salary. We're in a situation now where 400 Americans have wealth equal to the 154 million at the bottom of the American economic ladder. And President Obama is in a divided situation. He has to try to please voters on the left, liberals, progressives, people who see this wealth divide, but he also has to raise $1 billion from people who are the wealthy. So he's defensive because he's got two bosses. And Obama has shown himself in his first term to be a person who believes in market solutions, who's very friendly to Wall Street, who surrounds himself by Wall Street in his White House and on his cabinet, and that is what he's comfortable with. That is what he is. He made a speech to the Chamber of Commerce that laid out his second-term agenda, and it's not a person-friendly agenda. It's a big business-friendly agenda. So people expecting more in his second term are going to be very disappointed. So I think it's very clear Obama has two groups he's trying to please, and that's why he's defensive when he puts forward a very weak tax on the wealthiest.
But he did in 2008, he broke new ground by raising tons of money from small donors.
Well, that's what the media said, but when you look at OpenSecrets.org and compare it to previous elections, it's not all that significant. What he really did that was really breaking new ground in 2008 was he stopped playing by the rules of campaign financing. He dropped out of the campaign financing that undermined further public funding of elections. That did much more damage than anything else that he did as far as elections go. And he's allowed people like Karl Rove to do these anonymous contributions, which are illegal under federal election law. They were not made legal by Citizens United. They're illegal to provide anonymous contributions. They do it through a nonprofit organization, illegally using the IRS laws to circumvent the federal election laws. Obama could stop that right now. If the Department of Justice would enforce the laws, we could have clean elections, at least no anonymous contributions in our elections. But he's not even doing that. Now Obama's going for the first billion-dollar campaign. He is the destructor of money in politics. He is the, about the worst we have seen as far as money in politics goes, despite the image of having a grassroots campaign. It was Goldman Sachs that got him through Iowa.
But just in closing there, Kevin, how does, since our politics are money driven, how does he have a chance against the Republicans? I mean, they've got endless donors as well. I mean, what?
The only way Obama has a chance is if he becomes a populist. That's what most Americans are. On our website, October2011.org, we have on the front page 7 issues that super majorities of Americans support. If Obama adopts those 7 issues, he'll be on the side of 2/3 of the American public. He'll excite the American public and he'll get reelected. If he plays this weak Democrat position that's almost a Republican, some say it is a Republican position, his policies, if he takes that kind of position, it's going to be very hard for people to get excited about his campaign. And if the Republicans don't shoot themselves in the foot and, you know, pick someone like Rick Perry or Bachman, if they pick someone like Romney, I think a lot of Americans will stay home and not vote for Obama. He'll lose. His best hope is the Republicans get extreme or Obama becomes a populist. That's what he needs to do. He needs to represent the people, recognize who his real bosses are. We are the 99%. They are the 1%. Right now, Obama is in the 1% category.
Well, Kevin, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Kevin Zeis, who is an attorney and activist who served as Ralph Nader's press secretary and spokesman in 2004. He ran for Maryland's U.S. Senate seat on the Green Party ticket in 2006 and was the only person ever nominated by the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, and the Populist Party. He's co-director of It's Our Economy, and he's organizing a expansion of the Occupy Wall Street to Occupy Washington, D.C. on October the 6th, the 10th anniversary of the Afghanistan War. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether or not the United States and Pakistan can or will get a divorce. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Vali Nasser, who is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. He's the author of The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as the senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vali Nasser.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And do you think that it's possible for the United States and Pakistan to get a divorce? They're certainly talking like angry spouses. What used to be muttered in private about Pakistani duplicity is now being publicly and bluntly stated by senior American officials like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs?
Well, what has been revealed is not new. The fact that the Pakistanis had relationship with the Taliban, that they supported extremist elements and still do, is well known to the United States going back all the way to 2011. What is new is the decision by the United States to make all of this public and therefore put public pressure on Pakistan to abandon its current course. It's not possible for the two countries to have a divorce, largely because the stakes for both of them is quite high. And going from engagement to confrontation will not be easy, least of all for the United States.
So there is also, I understand, a kind of another level. It reminds me of the Cold War of that indicates how this relationship has soured, I think, largely since Osama bin Laden was killed, hiding out right next to the Pakistan's military academy. My understanding is that the United States ambassador is restricted from traveling inside Pakistan, that he wanted to go to the opening of a hospital that was paid for by U.S. taxpayers' money, and the Pakistanis prevented him. And that used to go on during the Cold War with the Russians, but it surprises me that it's going on between two supposed allies. I'm sorry, it's hard. Could you repeat that? We appear to have lost that signal. Hello? Hello? I think we've lost the call. Can you call him right back, please? We're talking with Vali Nasser, who's a professor of international politics at Tufts University. Between 2009 and 2011, he served as the Obama administration's senior advisor. He served as a senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, Richard Holbrooke, of course, who died in office. So we're trying to reestablish contact. Unfortunately, we're on a cell phone. So hopefully we'll be back talking with Vali Nasser. And we do have him, right? Sorry, you're back now. I guess you went into.
Yes, I'm sorry. I was saying that, you know, some of this happened before. For instance, when in January a member of the U.S. Embassy was alleged to be with the CIA, was arrested by Pakistan after he shot two people who ambushed him, and that sort of revealed the fact that the United States may have operatives in Pakistan that Pakistanis don't know about. And then you had the Bin Laden case, where the United States carried out a very high stake operation, again, without the knowledge of Pakistan, which suggested that although we're allies, that there is a massive gulf of distrust, and there are things that the United States is doing in Pakistan in order to protect its security that it's doing without the knowledge of the Pakistanis.
So my understanding, though, is that arguably, as prickly as relationships between the U.S. military and the Pakistani military are, and Tuesday's New York Times has an extensive story about a shootout on the border with Afghanistan in 2007 in which the Pakistanis murdered an American officer. The Pakistani people are probably even more anti-American than the military are, aren't they?
Yes, I mean, the mood in Pakistan towards the United States has never been favorable, and it has increasingly become more anti-American as a consequence of particularly the United States' use of drones to hit terrorist targets. And since the relations between Pakistan and the United States have plummeted beginning in January and then with the Bin Laden case and now with these public revelations, is becoming even more hostile. The problem with that is that it actually even decreases further the maneuvering room that the Pakistan military could potentially have to address U.S. demands. In other words, the country is now quite intolerant of the military leadership taking any steps in the direction of the United States. And therefore, one shouldn't foresee that the Pakistanis would now change course as a consequence of the revelations.
Well, the Pakistanis apparently, the foreign minister mentioned a new program of cooperation with China in terms of dealing with Islamic terrorists in the Uyghur territory of China, which seemed to me a fairly kind of crass pivot towards China. That's not a realistic option for the Chinese, is it? I mean, for the Pakistanis to somehow replace the American patron with the Chinese patron?
No, but it has public relations value in the sense that it tells the Pakistani people that they are not alone and isolated. But there are other things that the Pakistanis are doing that does have a consequence. For instance, Pakistan has restarted negotiations with Iran about building a pipeline, a gas pipeline from Iran to Pakistan. This idea was on the table. The Bush administration scuttled it through its own aid and engagement with Pakistan. It had remained off the table, and now the Pakistanis are putting it back on the table. I mean, put together, China, Iran, Saudi Arabia will not replace the United States, but it does provide the image that Pakistan is not isolated and it has other options. And it also is basically sending a signal to the U.S. that that if Pakistan were to get closer to Iran and were to follow a different regional strategic course, that it might even have the room to defy the United States further. And this is largely to do with the fact that the U.S. is threatening to cut off aid to Pakistan completely. And in that case, Pakistan has to tell its own people where it's going to substitute that aid.
But surely the Pakistanis have more leverage over us than we have over them, particularly given that all of the supplies, almost all of the supplies for the war in Afghanistan are trucked through Pakistan. I believe that some of it comes through the north, but that's expensive. And I take it even though there's a route from the Persian Gulf through Iran into Herat, that's not – obviously, we're not having particularly good relations with Iran. Now, but when you mentioned a possibility of an alliance with Iran and Pakistan, my understanding is actually the Iranians are actually quite close to the Indians. And that is what makes the – and India, of course, is what makes Pakistan paranoid about anything that they're doing inside of Afghanistan.
Yes, but we've done a very good job of souring relations between India and Iran. And so they're not as close as they once were. And but the key question is that in the short run, which means within the next year or so, Pakistanis have more leverage on us, not only because of the supply routes, which carry at least 60% of U.S. supplies into Afghanistan, but we greatly depend on Pakistan for the stability of Afghanistan. The assumption is that the Pakistanis are not doing anything, but they are doing a minimal amount, which if they were even to stop doing as much as they're doing, it will impact the security in Afghanistan very precipitously. So, you know, the Pakistanis have time to wait. That's what they think, that they have time to wait. But the United States has a much shorter schedule in an election year in order to execute its exit strategy from Afghanistan, and that makes it much more dependent on Pakistan than otherwise. So in the long run, we don't depend on Pakistan. Pakistan depends on us for aid and assistance and varieties of things. But in the very short run, this relationship is actually lopsided in their favor. And, you know, in an election, they calculate that it's an election year. The United States has already decided to leave Afghanistan. It needs a piece of security in Afghanistan, and therefore they have some room to maneuver.
Again, I'm speaking with Vali Nasser, who served as senior advisor to the Obama administration's special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. So, Vali Nasser, what explains then, if Admiral Mullen is correct, and there's no reason to think that he's not, I believe they've got some forensic evidence of the ISI's involvement with the Haqqani terrorists who occupied that unfinished building and shot at the U.S. embassy for a whole day. If this is a case of an ISI operation, what's going on here? I mean, where in the chain of command does it go? Would the leadership of Pakistan, how would they profit from this kind of, flagrant stabbing the Americans in the back?
Well, the Haqqani network has very close ties with the Pakistan military, and that goes a long time back. But whether or not this particular operation was actually ordered in a direct way by Pakistani leaders remains to be seen. But largely is that the Pakistanis have no vested interest in our strategy for Afghanistan. We want to create a government in Afghanistan that would be independent of Pakistani influence. We want to build a large military in Afghanistan that would make sure that the government of Afghanistan remains independent of Pakistani influence. And we are negotiating all sorts of strategic relationships with Afghanistan. And we are essentially trying to create an Afghanistan that is viable and is independent of Pakistani control. And Pakistan is not sold on this idea. And therefore, they are not doing much in order to assist in what we wish to do. All along, the way we have dealt with Pakistan is that, you know, it's been two steps forward, three backwards, and then, you know, two steps forward, one backward. But we've sort of tried to keep them engaged and at least minimalize their what might be unhelpful behavior on their part. I assume that the Admiral Mullen reflected a certain frustration within the U.S. military that this process is too slow given the needs of the U.S. Strategy for Afghanistan,
sure,
and has decided to change course and put much more direct pressure on Pakistanis to get them to where we want them.
Well, when 80 American troops get blown up, Mullen's probably getting a lot of anger up the ranks. I thank you for joining us, Vali Nasser.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, there is a great deal of frustration within the American military regarding the fact that some of the most intransigent and intractable terrorists in Afghanistan are associated with Pakistan, or they operate out of Pakistani safe havens, and Pakistan has not has dragged its feet in terms of shutting down those safe havens.
Sure.
So, a strategy of patience is basically run its course, and the U.S. has become much tougher.
I thank you for joining us here today, Vali Nasser.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Vali Nasser, who served as senior advisor to the Obama administration's special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about retirement heist, how companies plunder and profit from the nest eggs of American workers.
It's a standard procedure. I forgot to mention that grandma's pension will ease the rent book tension. A little birdie told me you've been siphoning the poor box. I heard the knitting circle discussing chub locks. What's all the commotion? What do they expect? No sign of a promotion. I lost my self-respect, you see.
Send me a postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view. Precisely what you mean to say. You're sincerely wasting away. Give me your answer. Fill in a form. Mine forevermore. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Schultz, who's an investigative reporter and author who has covered the retirement crisis for more than a decade. Formerly with the Wall Street Journal, her reporting has led to congressional hearings, proposed legislation, and investigations by the Treasury and the GAO. She has won dozens of journalism awards for economics, financial, and investigative reportings, including 3 Polk Awards, 2 Loeb Awards, and a National Press Club Award. In 2003, Schultz was part of a team at the Wall Street Journal who were awarded the Pulitzer Prize for articles on corporate scandals. Her latest book just out is Retirement Heist: How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ellen Schultz.
Thank you for having me.
And your book comes out at a time where so much of the national political debate is about the public insurance program, if you will, retirement program called Social Security, which presidential candidates on the Republican side are referring to as a Ponzi scheme. I mean, I guess your book is really an object lesson. It should be for all of those people engaged in this debate. If the subtext for killing Social Security is the free market version of Social Security.
Yes, well, what's pretty shocking is that the same people who are pushing to kill off Social Security are those that were involved very heavily in helping employers, private employers, kill off their pension plans. And people are probably aware that a lot of companies have frozen the plans or have terminated them. And usually the companies say they had no choice, that they became too expensive and people got old and they weren't able to compete internationally with other countries. But what people aren't aware of is that this so-called crisis was caused largely by employers who withdrew billions of dollars from their pension plans over the past 15 to 20 years. And they used the money to finance restructuring, to pay their own executives, and they even sold the assets in mergers and acquisitions deals. So the result of all of this is all this money coming out of pension plans. When the market cratered in 2008, there was no more surplus cushion that was to soften the blow, and the plans have become underfunded. So, of course, employers are now freezing the plans.
Well, and your book profiles some of the largest corporations in the United States, AT&T, Bank of America, IBM, Cigna, General Motors, GE, Comcast, UPS, and the NFL. Just explain, though, how systematically the protections for workers in pensions were dismantled to favor the executives.
Well, it was a long process that began largely in the 90s. There was about $1 trillion in benefits owed to older workers, you know, built up over a couple of generations of post-war employees. And employers began to work with consulting firms and law firms to discover or exploit loopholes that would enable them to take money out or to use the plans for corporate purpose. And the people didn't notice, actually, that back in the 90s, many of the companies were quietly cutting pension benefits for the older employees by as much as 50%. And yet people didn't notice because the companies, in many cases, actively deceived the employees by telling them that they were just modernizing the pension plan and making it better for the new modern mobile workforce. In fact, the goal was to deliberate. It was to cut benefits, which not only enabled the company to hang on to the money and then use it for other things, but it also boosted their profits thanks to the way accounting rules worked. So unfortunately for employees and retirees, this was occurring at the same time that executive pay was changing so that more of it was tied to performance and stock price. So you had a direct temptation for the top executives. So whether, you know, deliberately or not, if they were cutting benefits for retirees and employees, this was indirectly boosting their own pay and their own executive pensions. So what we've seen is a dramatic shift in retirement benefits, you know, at companies where the liabilities, of course, for regular employees are shrinking, but they have grown into just mountainous sizes for top executives. So there are even some companies where the only pensions are for the executives. There's nothing left for anybody else.
Well, let's take the example of General Electric, a big corporation that doesn't pay federal income tax on vast profits. There, in your book, Ellen Schultz, Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers, there are heartbreaking stories of destitute seniors. And then juxtaposed against these are these, you know, huge pension funds for the executives, $25 billion at General Electric. And to get to this point, General Electric basically, and all these other corporations, tried to float the notion that the companies were bleeding cash. And General Electric hasn't contributed a cent to the workers' pension plan since 1987 and still has enough money to cover all of its current and future liabilities. So this is a legal form of theft, right? When they talk about Social Security being a Ponzi scheme, what would you call this?
Well, it's funny because the companies characterize it as, this was sort of a gratuity, you know. It'd be nice if we could pay you this, but, you know, we just can't afford to. And in fact, this was compensation that people earned, you know, when they went to work. You know, back in the 50s and 60s and even the 70s, the trade-off was you'll have a slightly lower salary today because some of your pay is deferred. in the form of a pension or health care in retirement. So people, of course, when the time came to tap into that, the employers were trying to find ways to not pay it out. And they did find those ways. And I've seen just tragic results for many. You know, there were pilots, for example, at the airlines, many of which declared bankruptcy after starving their pension plans and paying their top executives millions of dollars. What happened was that a lot of the older pilots ended up with almost no pension thanks to, you know, some quirks in the PBGC, which is the federal pension insurer. So one guy he'd been receiving $7,000 a month, which was both his own deferred savings plus pension, but he lost almost all of it. You know, I think the last I heard from him, he was getting about $95 a month. And this is legal. And it's happened at many companies.
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Schultz, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, formerly with The Wall Street Journal, the author of a new book, Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers. So this... I'm trying to get an understanding, though, of how corporate culture in this country changed and how this kind of license to steal has become standard operating procedure. The corporations, as you know, Ellen, spend a lot of money on advertising, telling us how wonderful they are and what great corporate citizens are, how they care about us and care about the environment and all this stuff. And yet your story just is so cruel. What enabled this? Is this these kind of business schools like Harvard and Wharton where they teach these future executives all of this kind of military-type nonsense like take no prisoners, slash and burn, and all of those kind of metaphors for ruthlessness?
Well, there's always been a temptation, as long as pensions have been around, the temptation has been for companies to try and not pay them out. And that's why they enacted federal pension law back in the 70s. But over time, employers realized that there were strategies they could use to get around the federal law. And the real tipping point came in the early 90s, thanks to these new accounting rules. Now, people didn't pay much attention to these rules, but they essentially gave employers a way to convert the promises to millions of people into income immediately. It's like they were canceling a big debt in the future. And that future debt, which they were not planning to pay out anyway, gets translated into profit. It's not cash profit, but it affects earnings the same way. So this, of course, occurred when the executive pay was being tied to performance, and so you had this sort of a spiraling effect taking place. And people weren't aware of it. They still aren't aware when companies deceive them about the liabilities in their plans. You know, very often companies say, look, our costs have just spiraled over the past 2 years. In fact, if you look at their financial filings, you'll see they have a lot of flexibility to actually raise or lower their liabilities just by, you know, changing a few of the assumptions they use. One of the companies that was most successful at doing this was Lucent, which was a spinoff of AT&T. Now, they were spun off, and they ended up with this giant portfolio of retirees, which were like Western Electric, some of the Bells, and they claimed immediately that they couldn't afford to be paying all these benefits to this population of 130,000 retirees. What they don't tell you is they started out with more than enough money to pay all the pensions and all the health care. There was no doubt about that. But they nonetheless went about cutting the benefits and using the money from the plan for other things. And the biggest example of this, which was so shocking to many of the older people, is they had been promised a death benefit, which was equal to their last year of pay. So if somebody had earned $40,000 their last year, that's what the death benefit would be. And all these older couples were really counting on that, you know, to pay for medical expenses, burial costs. And the company canceled that, saying, absolutely can't afford to pay out $400 million as these folks die. So they canceled it, and then the very same year, they gave roughly $400 million in bonuses to the top executives. So there's such a shift in where the assets are going. Take Massey Energy, the giant coal producer, which was in the news last year because of the Big Branch mining disaster where you know, dozens of miners died. When the CEO of that company left at the end of last year, pushed out essentially, the amount that he took with him was his retirement package exceeded the entire amount paid to all the retired miners for their health care, for their black lung disease, for their pensions. So we're talking about one person ended up with more money paid out than all the thousands of sick and dying miners that were receiving much smaller benefits, of course.
Well, it still leaves you kind of absolutely stunned trying to figure out how this is an acceptable kind of corporate culture. As you know, Ellen, in Japan, they have a pretty strict ratio of corporate CEOs pay to the people on the shop floor. I think it's like 12 to 1 or 20 to 1 at the most. And in America, it's, what, 1,000 to 1 or something now?
Yeah, the people focus on the pay, but the real money isn't in the pay. It's in the executive pensions. So a lot of the compensation gets delivered that way, and it's done in such a way that you can't really see how much they're getting, and the amount sort of spikes at the very end. There's a parallel with public pension plans. You know, everybody's complained that public plans aren't funded well enough, and people were given higher benefits than they should have had. And a lot of that's kind of exaggerated, but the parallel with executives is their plans are not funded, usually, and the amounts are lowballed, so if they do report the liability, it's either hidden or undercounted. And then just as they're leaving, their benefits spike because they can do a number of things to boost their compensation, which boosts their pension. You know, you could freeze everybody else's pension plan, and that could save you $100 million and push up the stock price, then thus push up your pay and your executive pension essentially for the rest of your life. So there's been that sort of tied effect between what they do with regular employee benefits and what's happened with the executives. The other surprising thing I found was how they were trying to finance, how they do try to finance the executive pensions. And one is to use loopholes that enable companies to use money from the regular rank and file, you know, a salaried union retirement plans, and use that to pay for some of the executive pensions. Like I came across some companies that were going into bankruptcy and paying out, you know, they're going to dump the pension, but the departing executives got a big payout from the regular pension plan. The other thing that shocked me, was the other way that companies have financed this is to take out billions of dollars of life insurance on their workforce. Now, this had been going on since the early 1990s, and people have been largely unaware of it. So there are policies covering millions of employees, like you, for example, or someone you know. It could be that their ex-employer has a policy on them. When they die, the benefits are going to the company, of course, not to the families. A lot of this was done secretly, so these millions of workers are covered by life insurance, and the companies just use the policies as tax shelters to fund executive benefits. And then as people die, you know, retirees, ex-employees, the companies get the death benefits. It goes straight into their coffers. And this has been ramping up even in recent years. The banks, which pay such huge benefits to their executives, took out billions of dollars during the subprime crisis. So you have, you know, just the equivalent of, you know, billions of dollars on bank employees out there, many of whom, of course, don't have benefits themselves. In the book, I write about one fellow who had a brain tumor, and he was fired because he couldn't perform his job very well. When he died, his widow discovered that the company got more than $1 million for her husband's death. And she only found out by accident because a piece of paperwork that should have gone to the company came to her home. So this was a widow with two small children. Again, you know, she wasn't given life insurance her husband had no life insurance from the company because it was canceled when he died, but the company nonetheless got more than $1 million from his death.
Well, this is, it's heartbreaking, but it's also infuriating, Alan Schultz, and again, I'm struggling to understand how, this kind of, the amorality of this, the notion that these corporate executives see themselves as being so valuable that their value is greater than the entire sum of all of their employees. I just don't understand this on a human level. What has happened here to this country? Does that bother you? I mean, it obviously does, but I'm sorry to struggle with these questions.
Yeah, but I think that, having talked to some of these executives, although the companies were not at all forthcoming, or talking to some of the consultants who also were not forthcoming, they believe that they're doing the right thing. They believe that their top executives deserve to be paid a great deal. And they all have sort of convinced themselves that they have to do this for the benefit of the company. And I know that in many cases, the HR people, human resources people, they're deceived themselves. The companies tell them, well, we have this terrible liability, we can't afford it. And people believe it when the finance, the CFO, people at that level are telling them that the pensions are too costly, and they have to cut them. I had, talked to HR people who were just totally unaware that what they were telling people wasn't true. When they were telling people, oh, this new pension's better for you, they themselves didn't know that this so-called better pension is actually going to cut the benefits by 20 to 50%. They themselves, when they were offering people lump sums to retire early, and health care to reach 65 with coverage, they believed that people were getting a fair pension and would get health care when, in fact, the companies were shortchanging the pensions and had no intention of paying those health care benefits. Because we saw at Unisys, the company there, convinced 20,000 managers to retire early with the promise of health care, which is very critical. You need something to bridge you till age 65 and Medicare kicks in. So these, tens of thousands of fellows took the packages, and then a few years later, Unisys canceled the coverage, saying they could not afford it. In fact, they could afford it, they just chose not to pay out these benefits.
Well, just in closing, Alan Schultz, tell us how this retirement heist in corporate America was enabled by politicians, as it clearly was, because there is federal oversight, and it's been weakened. As you say, it started in the 90s. That's the Clinton era. I'm trying to figure out how this was done, and obviously with a money-driven political system that we have, wouldn't be surprising if lobbyists were involved.
Well, yes, the lobbyists very rigorously and always have. There was actually a moment in the 90s where the IRS was aware that companies were using a loophole to discriminate in favor of their high-paid executives. There's a rule in tax law that says if you've got a pension or a 401k plan, you're getting tax breaks for that. That's subsidized by taxpayers, so you have to treat everyone more or less the same. You can't play favorites. This was to stop employers from just offering these plans to executives. They can offer separate plans, and they do. They all offer bigger, richer plans to executives. But for the regular rank-and-file, broad-based pension or 401k, they're supposed to treat everyone pretty much the same. But what employers did was discover or exploit loopholes that let them, in fact, play favorites and deliver an extra helping of benefits to their highly compensated people. And the IRS tried to crack down. They pushed back. They've always been beaten back by just a volley of lobbying from top law firms, many of which have lawyers that have sort of cycled in and out of the Treasury in top positions. So the IRS has tried to stop some of these practices, but they just get stymied. And there are a few lawmakers who have really been aware of what's going on, because the lobbyists get in there, they reach the staffers, and they say, look, you know, look how expensive these plans are. We have to cut benefits, or we need the law to change to let us have less regulation. So there's been a steady push to weaken the already extremely weak protections, always in the name of improving retirement security. Employers have argued, don't make us put money into our pension plans, because that way they'll be more secure, because we'll be able to put money in when we feel like it, and thus we'll offer the plans rather than terminate them. Well, these arguments have been very effective over the years. And, you know, Boehner, of course, was in the 2000s, was pretty much on the side of what the retirement industry was saying. A lot of the things that went into the so-called Pension Protection Act of 2006, all of which were ostensibly to improve retirement security, most of those things weakened it, actually, by giving employers more outs to not fund their pension plan when they were in financial trouble. So there's just been not just the volley of lobbying, but ignorance, of course, in the general public, including the congressional staffers, about how the accounting works. People are always being bamboozled by the accounting. The latest example of this I saw is this claim that the U.S. Postal Service should be canceled, or, you know, put out of its misery because it can't afford to pay for all those retiree health benefits. In fact, a lot of the claims about the size of the liability for those benefits are exaggerated, the same way employers have exaggerated the burden of their retiree health coverage as an excuse to cut benefits. So that's just, you know, the latest, you know, past week example of how employers are able, or in this case, political groups have been able to manipulate the public perception about things, as they are now with the public pensions. You know, there are, of course, some public pension plans that are in terrible shape because the lawmakers, you know, got together with the unions and told people they'd get bigger pensions in the future in lieu of better pay today. And, of course, they didn't fund it. But most public plans are, the majority, they aren't over-rich, they don't over-promise, and they're funded. So what we're always focusing on are the terrible ones, so that people are, you know, they fall into this pattern of thinking that public employees are overpaid, their pensions are too rich. In fact, that's not the case for most of them.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ellen Schultz.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ellen Schultz, who's an investigative reporter and author who's covered the retirement crisis for more than a decade. Formerly, she's with the Wall Street Journal, and her latest book just out is Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.